This year, Iowa lawmakers failed to approve legislation that would have designated more funding for water quality initiatives. This hour, water quality from a federal perspective. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, I'll talk with David Zwertny of the University of Iowa. Zwertny is one of 35 science and technology experts who've spent the past year working in the U.S. Congress as part of a fellowship program. Then in the second half hour, we'll listen back to a conversation from earlier this year about how redistricting has shaped our politics and its divisiveness. That's all coming up. First, this news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled, and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In this first half hour, we want to get an Iowa perspective on some of the most pressing environmental issues facing us here in the U.S. My guest is David Zwertny. He's an expert in water quality and water resources, and David is one of 35 science and technology experts who've spent the past year working in the U.S. Congress as part of a fellowship program sponsored by the American Association for the Advancement of Science. He was a congressional fellow with the Energy and Commerce Committee. He joins me now. Hello, David.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you on. I want to mention you're Associate Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Iowa, also Director of the Environmental Policy Research Program at the UI Public Policy Center. We're reaching you in Washington, D.C., I understand, but your fellowship is over, right?
Yeah, it is. It's just coincidental timing that I got back to Iowa for about a week, taught my first class, and then had to fly back for a more traditional conference for a professor. It's the American Chemical Society meeting that I'm here for.
Mm-hmm. So you started this fellowship, which just finished up a year ago, last September, interestingly, while President Obama was still in office. So you've had that transition period. I hope to ask you about that in a few minutes. But let's talk about your actual work here. Give us an overview of your tasks over the past year under this fellowship.
Yeah, so I think it's important to start that, you know, most people are probably familiar with staffers that work in a member of Congress's office, and they really handle the day-to-day activities for that member. I was part of a committee staff, and so legislation gets directed to different committees in each chamber. And if you're a chair or a ranking member of that committee, you get to hire additional staff that's responsible for sort of being expert sort of support on all the issues that are relevant to that committee's jurisdiction. So I was one of about eight people that helped the Democrats on the Energy and Commerce team on issues related to energy and environment. And every day was a little bit different, just depending on what the issues of the week were. You know, one of these things that you don't appreciate till you're there is the majority party sets the agenda. And so oftentimes we would just have to wait and hear what issues they wanted to work on, and we'd respond. And so every day was a bit different, but most of what we were there to do is just make sure that the ranking member of our committee, who's Frank Pallone out of New Jersey, had policy proposals that were consistent with what the Democrats were trying to do in energy and environment, as well as messaging, things to say, talking points, statements that sort of reflected the vision for the Democratic Party in those issues.
Mm-hmm. So your typical day included, perhaps it wasn't long-range forecast, and you would come on a typical day. You might not know what you would have. You'd show up, and things would be presented to you?
Absolutely. The very first day I started, I worked with some great people on the team at Energy and Commerce, and one of the first things they said is, you know, part of your job is to know the news and follow the news. And particularly after the election and the new administration, there would be a lot of fires that would pop up in the energy and environment space, and the committee would largely just sort of work on messaging statements, releases, fact sheets. We did a lot of writing, and it was mostly just in terms of issues that were within our jurisdiction that our members needed to be well-versed on. So a lot of it was sort of reactionary. There was an opportunity for some long-range planning. If we had core agenda issues that we were working on and there were some that were sort of a common thread throughout my time. That was always sort of there in the background to be worked on, and maybe those were, you know, a particular bill that the Democrats were trying to get some traction on. But a lot of it was just day-to-day sort of responding to the ups and downs of sort of how things work in D.C. when something, you know, maybe a new bill is introduced that you don't necessarily agree with, or maybe the new administration wants to roll back a policy and you want to get a statement out on that. Every day was unique.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's kind of the before and after part of this picture as a staffer for the Energy and Commerce Committee. Let's talk about some of the specific issues that you tackled in as an expert in water quality and water resources. For instance, I mean, did the issues you looked at and tackled really, were they under this umbrella of water quality, or did you have to go outside as well?
Yeah, you know, I got really lucky. Part of the reason, you know, as a fellow, you had a choice. I mean, it was a pretty extensive process that AAAS puts us through to find your right home on the Hill. And I was really eager to work with the folks at Energy and Commerce because I knew the issues they were going to be working on this year. So I research water quality and water treatment at the University of Iowa. And the very first thing that I actually got to contribute to from day one, and maybe been in the office a week, and the bill that was making its way on the floor of the House was the Water Resources Development Act. It's abbreviated down to WRDA. And that was relevant to our committee because there were funds in there to help the communities in Flint after the lead contamination that they had. And so I think one of the first things I did where I actually felt like I might be contributing is I made a small contribution to talking points that our ranking member delivered on the House floor about WRDA. You know, everything that we do is sort of as a team, and I don't want to take any more credit than what I was doing. I was still sort of pretty low on the totem pole, but even getting to make those contributions right away on an issue that was so close to what I care about with respect to water quality and everything that happened with the public health crisis in Flint, it was a really excellent start to the year. And then, you know, for symmetry's sake, it ended on a really high note where the last thing that we passed through the committee in a bipartisan fashion was amendments to the Safe Drinking Water Act. And so it was the first chance to amend Safe Drinking Water Act in about 20 years, and there's good funds in there to help communities improve water infrastructure and a lot of other provisions that the committee had been working on for some time in a bipartisan fashion to, you know, Democrats and Republicans together to really improve the nation's water resources. And so that was a really sort of nice high point to end on, because you can see the media and you can hear about political polarization in the rancor in D.C., but there are some issues that the members of Congress feel, and rightly so, are too important to be partisan about. And you know, safety of your drinking water supply is one of them. And I think the committee and the people on the committee staff that work on these issues did a fantastic job to prepare a bill that hopefully now has to go from the committee to the House floor onto the Senate. But everyone's optimistic.
Mm-hmm. I've spoken with other staffers that have had similar experiences. Viewed from afar, Washington at this time looks particularly divisive, dysfunctional. But you're telling me that you have some confidence there. But you are at a lower level where you're preparing bills, right? And so the real divisiveness happens above you, or not necessarily above you, but further along in the process. Is that what you're saying?
No, I think really what I'm trying to get at is, you know, part of what's the allure of a committee staff position is, you know, the people that are on the committee staff really are involved deeply with the development of policy. They're the ones that are drafting the key provisions in bills. They're the ones that are working with the other party to truly, really find compromise. And so what I mean by that is there's only so much as a fellow that sometimes you're allowed to do. And so some of those negotiations where things really got worked out, sometimes to the wee hours of the morning, to the last minute before the bill actually had to be discussed in committee, was done by the people that I worked under. And I guess I would say that, I mean, there are some issues. The Committee of Energy and Commerce has always prided itself on being one that tries to be as bipartisan on some of the key issues that it deals with. And, you know, I wouldn't say, I guess what I would say about the drinking water bill that was on through the committee right before I left is that it's what maybe a good example for what policy should be is I don't think either side got everything they wanted. So both sides are willing to come to agreement and meet in the middle and find something that really could still do some good, even though everyone was willing to sort of compromise. Not every issue is that way. I mean, there's certainly working in the energy and environment space with the current administration, those aren't top priorities. And so the water bill is one example of a success. And I think there, especially for the Democrats on the committee, there's been a lot of frustration with some of the lack of prioritization in those areas.
Right. If water, safe drinking water, is an area where there's a lot of bipartisan support, what's another area that you worked on, perhaps a bill that you worked on, where you just saw really some partisan rancor there, or just divisions?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, and that's one of the issues would be, so it was energy and commerce and energy and environment. So the energy actually weighs really heavily. And so within energy, just different approaches for how we want to handle our energy resources. Obviously, one party, the Democrats, are pretty big and pro-renewable, and those weren't always issues that the majority party wanted to work on. One that comes to mind, too, that's sort of in loosely related to energy, but more air quality issues. I mean, there was bills that were put forward that were considered by the committee to sort of weaken standards for ozone. And so ozone is one of these things that has real public health effects in terms of being linked to asthma, and the Obama administration put in some new provisions to lower the standard, to increase public health gains through the Clean Air Act. And there was a bill that was put forward by the Republicans to raise that standard so that it was not as stringent as it was under the Obama administration. And so, you know, those are things where you can get into some real partisan back and forths. And I think that's where just, you know, the House of Representatives is a majority vote House. And so, you know, the Democrats didn't have the majority or the numbers on those votes. And so those bills usually made it out of committee, but usually split right down party lines.
Okay. If you just join us, my guest this half hour is David Swertny of the University of Iowa College of Engineering. For the past year, he just finished up one of 35 science and technology experts who've spent time working in the U.S. Congress as part of a fellowship program sponsored by the American Association for the Advancement of Science. David is an expert in water quality, water treatment, water resources. You know, viewed from this vantage point of Washington with your experience, 1 year experience behind you, you know, water quality, of course, David, is one of those issues where control is fought over between states and the federal government. We've seen it in our news in this past year, certainly. Did that surface in any of the work that you did?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think that drinking water bill we were discussing, there were a few state agencies, I think, that were, you know, being sort of a D.C. outsider, if you will, coming from the academic world and observing for a year, you see the power of different types of advocacy groups and, you know, it's lobbying. But as you think about different provisions that might go into a bill, some pushback by some organizations inside states that would say, you know, say if we wanted to regulate a new drinking water contaminant, some of the states would push back and say that would be a real challenge for us because of our ability to actually pay for the additional enforcement and the additional techniques we would need to monitor. So you certainly see that. The environment it's one of the things we, you know, from an environmental policy perspective, there's always that tug of war, if you will, in terms of EPA gives a lot of responsibilities to the states to implement and enforce, and states always are doing their best, but there's a lot of other factors that can come into play in terms of do they have the budgets and the personnel, you know, and maybe do they have there are some issues that if they were to be more aggressive in implementing, it might impact state economies. And so sometimes there's conflicts of interest there. And so I think you can't avoid that when you're thinking about the effectiveness of environmental policy that you're trying to develop. Will the states actually be able to do anything with it? And sometimes they're some of the bigger opponents to trying to push things forward.
Mm-hmm. Remind us, David, what water quality and resource issues are most relevant to us here in Iowa?
Well, obviously, we've been debating for the past few years in the State House in Des Moines over how we can handle nutrient management. And so I think with what was coming out of Des Moines and the waterworks and their lawsuit over nitrate contamination, I think we're constantly dealing in the state with how do we sort of sustainably conduct our agricultural economy that's so vital to the people that rely on it for their livelihoods, but do it in a way that we're not compromising our drinking water and surface water resources, particularly with all the reports that have been coming out that the long-term or the long-distance effects of our nutrients, with the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico being one of the largest it's ever been, and that's all coming from contamination that's coming out of the upper Midwest and the agricultural economy. And so, I think sooner or later, we're as a state going to have to figure out how to balance those interests and make sure that we can still keep everybody farming and be as agriculturally productive as we want to be, but do it in a way that's not impacting our water resources.
Mm-hmm. David, your time in Washington, D.C. bridged this transition from Barack Obama. You started in September of 2016 and just finished up here in August of 2017 on this fellowship in Washington, D.C. as a staffer. That must have been a very interesting transition. I wonder what it was like. What did you notice about the transition? What were the biggest challenges?
Yeah, that's a very good question to ask. I think first thing they warned us is that any election year is a bit of an odd year in D.C. There's fits and starts in terms of, you know, in October we started September 1 and everything was really busy, and then October came and everybody went home in the House of Representatives to campaign because there was an election. With the administration turnover and the result with President Trump winning the election, I think it caught everybody off guard. I imagine that's sort of pretty cliche by now, but I don't think of many folks in D.C. expected that outcome at all. The AAAS, through the orientation programs, trotted out speaker after speaker telling us that it was essentially a Clinton presidency as a foregone conclusion. So it caught a lot of folks off guard. Tangibly, we saw immediate effects because, again, energy and environment weren't really hot-button issues or at least priority issues for the new administration. If anything, they were looking to roll back provisions and not really do anything to advance energy and environment policy. And probably even more important, there were other issues they did want to prioritize, like health care. And so you sort of learn quickly that politicians are pretty outstanding with their stamina, but they do have limits. And, you know, there's only so much bandwidth they can process. And so, you know, first things first, right after the Trump administration took over, things were a little bit quiet for the committee because there were no energy and environmental issues to really work on. Mm. And then I think just as people sort of settled in, particularly on the Democratic side of issues that had been important, like renewable energies and climate change, and those being either not prioritized or maybe even rolled back with like the removal from the Paris Accord, you know, I think people that had worked for those issues and suddenly saw them going the other way, you know, it's hard not to see that, not to take that personally. And I think you see some of that with people that have been on the Hill for some time and worked passionately on those issues, that there's a little bit of dejection seeing those issues no longer be a priority.
Mm-hmm. And it, within the first 6 months of the Trump presidency, did you see any kind of evolution? How did that progress in the issues that you're most the environmental issues that you're most familiar with?
Yeah, you know, it certainly evolved. I mean, the committee. I should make sure I'm clear that the committee was broadly was always very busy. I mean, healthcare is within the jurisdiction of energy and commerce. It's got this really broad jurisdiction. It's one of the most sort of powerful committees in the House for as much as it actually contains and within its scope.
So you dealt with the health care bills that ultimately failed?
We weren't involved with it directly. We were the energy and environment team. There were about 8 of us, but I would say there's probably about 40 or 50 staff on the Democratic side for the entire committee, and they were within the different jurisdictions. So health care had its own staff, and telecommunications had its own staff. And so there was always something on the committee happening, but it wasn't necessarily an energy and environment.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, if anything, the energy and environment issues came on late. Everything in that space really started with executive orders from President Trump early on. And then after a while, I think they started realizing, whether it was, you know, as some of the other issues sort of made its way through the House, like health care or telecommunications, we started seeing more bills. That was where, like, we saw the ozone regulation bill, or we were able to still even do some bipartisan things like drinking water or environmental site cleanups through the brownfields program. So it eventually picked up, but it took a while for us to get to that amount of work. I would say it was like March or April by the time we really hit some sort of steady activity.
Mm-hmm. When you compare how you thought of Washington, D.C. and the way it works before going there from your academic world, from your staff or your faculty position at the University of Iowa to Washington, D.C., to what you know now, what do you count as your biggest surprises or areas of enlightenment?
You know, I'm gonna put a very optimistic spin on this because, you can hear a lot about the do-nothing Congress and you see the approval ratings, but there are so many people behind the scenes that are working their tails off, that are very passionate on these issues, that even though you may not see the issues get advanced in, say, the nightly news, or maybe even the bill falls apart and never really gets to the floor, there are people that are working really hard. And I actually came away sort of feeling really good about the people on the Hill that are working on these issues from an environmental perspective, someone who cares about the environment and energy resources. The team I worked with was phenomenal, and I'm glad to see there's such stellar, like, professionals there pushing those issues. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm going to choose to try to stay positive on it, because that's our political system. You've got good people on both sides, and a lot of the rhetoric that can happen at the top level really obscures all the hard work that goes on behind it. In fact, you know, the things you realize is we don't pay those people well enough. We talk about money in politics all the time. There are people that are working. They're working really long hours, working really hard on issues, and you know, they probably are doing it when they could be having more lucrative careers elsewhere in the private sector. But they really are passionate to work on issues for the government.
So you're back at the University of Iowa. Started your fall coursework in teaching. I wonder how this past year in Washington, D.C. has changed you as a faculty member at the University of Iowa College of Engineering. How will you approach your teaching, your research, in a different way than if you had not had this experience?
Yeah, so I'm very fortunate. Just before we left, we received a $3 million grant from the National Science Foundation to develop a new training program for graduate students in our department on sustainable development.
Well, and congratulations.
Thank you. We were really, you know, we always joked that it would be a nice problem to have if we got it, because we didn't expect to get it on our first try, and it's been a nice problem to have. But one of the goals that NSF wants us to do is try to think about training scientists and engineers in a more, you know, to prepare them to do more than just be professors, because that's sort of the tradition. And so we have this new program where we're going to be taking scientists and engineers in civil and environmental engineering and sort of expanding their horizons. So I actually get to teach them an environmental policy class, which would be quite fun. I'm leveraging my experiences and the issues and making sure that the students that are coming through our program see where the science they're doing in a lab fits in the broader political national landscape. And I think Iowa is a fantastic place to do this, because one of our focuses is on things like food and energy and water resources. We feed the world. We're one of the leaders in renewables. So we've got an outstanding class of 16 new students coming in that's going to really have an opportunity to see education done, I think, in a better way for them that will make them far more marketable once they're done with their degrees.
David, we have about a minute left. Tell me, from the personal experience side, what will be the highlights that you'll remember most about living and working in Washington, D.C., and working in our government?
Well, I mean, personally, it was great to be there with my family and my young kids, and we really enjoyed all that there is to do in D.C. Professionally, you know, we joked as fellows that it was always fun when you could, you know, we all aspired to be on C-SPAN at least once, so I can say that I got my C-SPAN FaceTime in. And it was always a thrill just to have any member of Congress actually use what you write for them, you know, actually, you know, benefit from your contributions. And so I have those types of memories of when my things were actually, you know, had their impact. And I also just have a real better appreciation for the House of Representatives. A lot of these members from other districts are working in, you know, without a lot of a high profile, but they're working hard. And I should say, I'd be remiss to say that our representative, Mr. Loebsack from Iowa's 2nd District, was on the committee, and so I got to interact with him and his staff some, and that was really enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we've run out of time. Thank you very much. David Swertny of the University of Iowa College of Engineering. He was one of 35 science and technology experts spending the past year working in the U.S. Congress as part of a program sponsored by the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Nice talking with you, David. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Ben. I really appreciate you having me on.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll listen back to a conversation from earlier this year about how redistricting has reshaped our politics. That's coming up. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled, and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
Glad to have you back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This half hour, we want to listen back to a conversation from earlier this year, a topic that, okay, it's not the sexiest, but it is incredibly important at this time in our politics: redistricting. Redistricting happens after each census. Now, if you remember, Iowa lost one congressional district in 2013. That was based on the results of the 2010 census. Our next census will be in 2020. Well, before 2013, Iowa had five districts. Now we only have four. Correspondingly, only four members of the House of Representatives from Iowa. Now, back in February, I had a conversation about redistricting and how that process has shaped our politics in recent years with Tracy Osborne, associate professor in political science at the University of Iowa, and Dave Daly, former editor-in-chief of Salon Magazine. He's also the author of a new book. I can't say the title on the air, so I'll just say Rat Bleeped, the true story behind the secret plan to steal America's democracy. Daly is in Iowa now. He was at Prairie Lights in Iowa City last night, Wednesday. Today, Thursday, he'll be speaking at the Iowa Federation of Labor, AFL-CIO convention in Altoona. Tracy Osborne, let me start with you. Get us up to speed on the fundamentals, a little bit more about redistricting, the reason we do it, and the thinking behind it.
Sure. So back in the 1960s, the Supreme Court decided that everyone's vote had to be equal. And what that meant was that they had, when they redraw the congressional districts, they all have to have basically the same population. But that's up to the states. And so the states get to decide exactly how they're going to draw those districts. So you can envision a state and you can really envision the many ways you could draw it to kind of do what you wanted to with those districts. And that's where we get the term gerrymandering. So gerrymandering is drawing the districts deliberately to help or to hurt a certain group. So here in Iowa, we're actually really unusual. We redistrict by an independent commission that is explicitly nonpartisan. So by state law, they cannot use partisan data. So what that means is they really redraw. They don't care where the representative lives. They don't actually care where the partisans live. And that's why we saw some controversy when we lost that seat in the last redistricting round. But a lot of other states allow their state legislature to redraw the lines, which means that the state legislature, whoever controls it, whichever party, has a lot of say over who's going to have how many seats. Mm-hmm. And that's where the problem comes in.
Mm-hmm. And so we saw in 2010, after that census, the Republicans in 2010 had a good turnout. They did well in that election. And you're saying and that made a big difference in a lot of states.
Absolutely, because that meant they controlled the redistricting process to draw the state legislative lines and the congressional lines.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking at Iowa's latest four districts, basically sort of four quadrants, the four corners of the state. Not quite that, but pretty much that. So Iowa's looking at it, we can say Iowa is rare in the country.
Absolutely.
How rare?
They are one of a kind. So independent redistricting commissions do exist in other places, but a lot of times they are sort of balanced partisan instead of nonpartisan. So an example is California. In 2008, they went to a retired judges commission and some citizens. It's very complicated. So I would say, you know, Google for details. But it's pretty rare. Most states do it by state legislature.
Dave Daly, let's talk a little bit, and later I want, of course, before we end our conversation, to get into possible remedies. But I know in a book that you had that came out last year with a subtitle, the title like has a word I can't say on the air, but the subtitle says it all, How the Democrats Won the Presidency but Lost America. So this is back in 2016. The central focus of your book is what is called the GOP Red Map Redistricting Plan. How does this fit in with sort of the fundamentals that Tracy has laid out for us?
She's laid it out perfectly. I think that, and Iowa, it's a pleasure to be having this conversation in Iowa because Iowa really is the redistricting unicorn. You all get it exactly right there, and it's a, you know, it's a pleasure to have a civic culture that sort of understands the importance that these district lines are really the building blocks of our democracy. And when they get twisted for partisan purposes, it takes our entire democracy in directions that are extreme, and it insulates politicians from the ballot box and the will of the voters. Gerrymandering goes back to the beginning of the country. You can trace it back to Patrick Henry trying to rig a race in Virginia in the very first Congress between James Madison and James Monroe. It has always been a part of us. What the Republicans do in 2010, however, is reinvent the game. If you all are familiar with Moneyball and baseball, kind of how baseball teams realized that there were loopholes within the system that could be exploited. And what the Republicans realized in 2010 is that state legislatures control not only redistricting of their own states, but they also control the redistricting of all of these congressional seats.
Mm-hmm.
And that in a closely divided country, many of these chambers are very, very close, and you could tilt control for not a lot of money. So the Republicans come up with a plan called Red Map. They invest $30 million in it. And the goal of this is to take control of as many chambers of state legislatures as they can across the country, some of which were only within, you know, two or three seats of doing this. So for $100,000 here, for $250,000 in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and North Carolina, you could take over control of the entire chamber. You could have complete control of redistricting, and you could draw whatever kind of lines you want. And by 2010, the technology is so good and our partisanship has become so hardened that it is really, really easy to draw virtually impregnable lines. Mm-hmm. And what you have seen over the last 6 years is very little movement in Congress in the states that have been redistricted in this way, and much more Republican control of state legislatures.
And so following your line of thinking, the more the safer a district is in the hands of any congressman, be it a Democrat or a Republican, the less that Republican or Democrat, that office holder, has to pay attention to what with the constituency? Or
I think that's exactly right. I think it's almost even worse than that. I think that when you are representing a district that is drawn so that you can't lose it, the only group you're really responsible to is the extreme base of that party, because the only way you can lose is if you face a primary challenge. You do not have to talk to the middle. You do not have to talk to the other side. You have to be sure that your base is completely okay with you and that nobody can get to your left or to your right and to win a primary challenge, because a primary challenge has a smaller electorate, a more active piece of the party base. It's usually held, over the summers, so turnout is smaller.
Uh-huh.
And it affects the kinds of people we send to Washington, and then it affects their willingness to work with the other side and compromise.
So, Tracy, back to you. Unlike the House of Representatives, the Senate is not based on – I mean, you referred to this 1960s Supreme mm-hmm. Court ruling. Of course, the Senate – all votes are not equal when we look at the Senate. We look at a state like Wyoming, little population, two senators. Look at a state like California, huge population in comparison, still two senators. So the Supreme Court said that's okay for the Senate, but it has to be different for the House of Representatives?
They did. And that's actually one of the most interesting things, where they demanded that states change their state Senate. So states have to redistrict their Senate and their House. They're not allowed to have a malapportioned legislature like the Senate. But the Constitution says you can't take away a state's two senators without their consent. So what state's uh-huh. going to be okay with that?
And Dave, going back to the topic of your book, that explains how the Democrats at one point had a nice majority in the Senate, but the House of Representatives was still deemed untouchable in 2012 or so.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it's really hard to gerrymander the U.S. Senate. I mean, there are ways to try to affect the votes. And what a lot of these gerrymandered legislatures do is then pass voting restriction laws that then try to affect the outcome of statewide races. But I mean, that's a different ball of wax in some ways. What you see in 2012 is that the Democrats take the U.S. Senate. Barack Obama is reelected. Democrats get 1.4 million more votes than Republicans in the aggregate nationwide for House of Representatives seats, but the Republicans hold on to a 234-201 majority. That's even starker when you look at sort of the key swing states in American politics.
Mm-hmm.
Ohio, where the Republicans have a 12-4 advantage. Pennsylvania, where Republicans have a 13-5 advantage. North Carolina, where it's 10-3. Michigan, where it's 9-5. You take a look at sort of all of these bluish, purplish states, and the delegations that they send to Washington when you add them up, it's 2-1 Republican, and that has a lot to do with the way the lines were drawn after 2010.
You've just joined us. Dave Daly is with me, former editor-in-chief of Salon Magazine. He's written for a number of national publications, also a book author. Tracy Osborne, associate professor in political science at the University of Iowa, director of the Politics and Policy Program at the PPC. So let's talk. There's a couple ways I want to go here. But first of all, let me talk about Tracy, aren't there any checks on this? I mean, can you gerrymander something so that you are in so solid, if you are the party in power, isn't there a court, say, that can tell, wait, and where is the line when they say, no, that's too far and that's okay?
Well, so far the Supreme Court hasn't drawn that line. They have considered some cases. You might remember the Texas case where they redistricted Tom DeLay's advice back in the kind of mid-2000s. And the Democrats were so mad they ran to New Mexico for a month to try to avoid the vote. But, you know, even though that case went to the Supreme Court has sort of opened the door saying we could imagine a case where partisan gerrymandering goes too far, but we haven't found it yet. Interestingly, there's a case sitting in the court right now in the Supreme Court about Wisconsin where the lower court has said, you know, this is too much partisan gerrymandering. And they've actually come up with this measure of trying to figure out, you know, are the parties wasting sort of equal numbers of votes, or, you know, is one party kind of utilizing all their votes really well and the other one's just wasting them left and right?
Yeah.
So if this case, you know, if the Supreme Court upholds that ruling, this is a huge watershed moment.
Mm-hmm. Dave Daly, when we look at gerrymandering on a spectrum of minor to egregious, is there any place that it makes sense to draw a line? This works and this is just too far.
Yes. I mean, I think we have to keep in mind that we want competitive districts. We want politicians not to be insulated from the ballot box. And we want to see true contests. One of the things you are seeing is that every single election cycle under these maps in state legislatures nationwide, the number of uncontested seats is soaring. In North Carolina this year, where there's been, you know, protests for going back years now, that the Moral Monday protests, 57 of the 120 seats for North Carolina's lower house were uncontested. In Wisconsin, it was 47 of 99 seats in this last election, completely uncontested. These are members of both parties looking at these races saying, I can't win that. So as a result, there is no dialogue, there's no debate, and there's no way to hold representatives accountable for their votes. And what you have seen, according to the political scientists who have measured this, is that the 2010 lines are in most cases three times as partisan as the ones that were drawn in 2000. This is the work of Michael Lattner at Cal Poly SLO, which has been a groundbreaking on this.
Mm-hmm.
You see that all of these states in which control of their local houses and control of their congressional delegations once swung back and forth, it's no longer swinging. The pendulum is stuck on one side, and that's not good or a democracy.
Mm-hmm. We have about 5 minutes left. Let's look toward the future, the next census, 2020. Is that our next juncture when there could be a fix, a remedy here? Or are we just going to say, well, maybe the Democrats will have a swing election in 2020? When that census is there, they'll get to in the states. And it's at a state level that we're thinking about, right, Tracy?
Yes,
that the state level, the national election, because it's the state entities, not in Iowa, especially because it's nonpartisan, but in most states that have those levers of power. And so what do you see in the future? How do we remedy this if we deem it to be undesirable, which according to polls, when we look at favorability, unfavorability towards our Congress, we're not happy.
Right. Most definitely. You know, that Supreme Court case I mentioned, I think, is a big part of the future. You know, if the Supreme Court starts to you know, put a hammer down on partisan redistricting. That could really change what goes on. The other thing is states are increasingly moving toward these kinds of independent commissions. Their outcome is really debatable. You know, California at first had a lot of competition after changing the way they did it, and then that's kind of died off a little bit.
Right.
So, you know, we have to ask ourselves, is redistricting the only thing we need to change, or are there other things that go along with this?
Mm-hmm. What do you see when you look in the future, Dave Daly, about a way to more competitive districts and better representative democracy?
I think Tracy's exactly right, first of all, about the Wisconsin case going to the Supreme Court. This case is tailor-made for Justice Kennedy to be the fifth swing vote. If Justice Kennedy sees that this is a workable standard to fix partisan gerrymandering, this would be the first time that the Supreme Court draws a bright line.
Have they heard that case? Have they heard that case yet, or just agreed to hear it?
They've agreed to hear it. I don't think they've heard it yet. Is that right, Dave?
They have not heard it yet, but if they take it up and if Justice Kennedy is amenable to this solution, this is huge news. I am less optimistic on the electoral front because I think that in order for the Democrats to get a seat back at the table in many of these states, it's so hard because Republicans have got super majorities in most of these states, and it's going to take not just a swing election, but an earthquake election to actually fix it. There are, however, a bunch of big state governors' races in 2017 and in 2018. 2017 is Virginia, and 2018 you have governors' races in Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Florida, and Wisconsin that are key because if the Democrats can take those seats, they would have a seat at the table in 2020, a seat they did not have in 2010. If the Democrats lose those elections, the governor's races, it's really hard to imagine a realistic scenario under which they take a legislative chamber and get themselves a seat at the table. So you could be looking at these maps being in play for another 10 years after this, with the technology only getting better. I mean, I think that this is a real crisis moment and that we ought to be thinking very, very seriously about how to move forward in a fair way.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, you mentioned earlier, Dave, about in, was it the 2014 election, the popular vote being in favor of the Democrats, even though the Republicans won out in terms of the number of seats. And this is due in large part, you say, to gerrymandering here. We had in our last election the electoral vote turnout, and I know these are two different things, but I want to see if there is a relation here. The electoral vote turnout in favor of Donald Trump when the popular vote was very clearly, except in our president's mind, in favor of Hillary Clinton. Is there any relation here between what you two were talking about and that?
Yes. I think there is, because if you think about this, the states that tipped the presidency to Donald Trump are some of the most gerrymandered states in the country. What we're talking about are Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, and in some ways North Carolina, and also Florida. Those states have in common that they are severely gerrymandered, that they are bluish-purplish states, mostly, especially as far as how they voted for president over the years, but they all have in common supermajorities of Republican control that have in the last 5 years passed really stringent voter ID and voter restriction bills that had dramatic impact in driving down the African-American and the Democratic vote in many of these states. I mean, Donald Trump's margin in Wisconsin is only about 20,000. It is assumed that the voter ID laws kept twice as many of those people away from the polls as made the margin of difference. So I think it is a connection that is complex to make. You have to say that these gerrymandered legislatures then take actions that make it harder for people to vote and affect future outcomes.
Mm-hmm. A quick word before we go, perhaps specifically about Iowa. I don't know. We have your example. You turned to Wisconsin, Michigan, and Ohio, Dave. But in Iowa, we have this unicorn of a model system here. But nevertheless, you know, Iowa went for Donald Trump almost by 10 points. Mm-hmm. So doesn't that sort of destroy your theory in any way, Dave?
No, I don't. I don't think so. I think elections have consequences and they should have consequences, but every election ought to have a consequence. It's not enough that the 2010 election has a consequence, 2012, 14, 16, all of them ought to matter and then swing back and forth. That the people of Iowa who went for Donald Trump in 2016 is entirely within their right. But the trick becomes when you don't have control of the ballot box to turn it the other way. What you see in Iowa right now is complete, I believe, control by the...
Yes, unified government for the first time in about 20 years, yep.
Because your districts are fairly drawn, if people don't like what the Republicans do, and I read the other day that a bunch of public service unions are
running out of time. Quickly, if I could ask you, Dave. Yep.
Absolutely. What is important is that the voters control the politicians and not that the politicians control the voters. And in states where redistricting is a severe partisan problem, it's the other way around.
A conversation from February of this year with Dave Daly and Tracy Osborne of the University of Iowa. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. It's a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.